tell me when you joined the Nixon CEA.
It would have been the summer of 1971.
Mm-hmm. Where were you before then?
I was teaching at Swarthmore, and I had been at Berkeley before then.
Mm-hmm. Did you replace someone who left?
Yeah, Rudy Penner. And we overlapped over the summer.
Mm-hmm. So you came at the beginning of the summer.
Right.
Do you, did you talk to anyone about what had gone on before?
Yeah.
Then, so would it be worthwhile talking a little bit about 69 and 70?
No, I think the most interesting thing I could tell you, or which you probably already know, mm-hmm. but I wasn't there, was what happened in terms of monetary policy, mm-hmm. so in the spring of 71, do you know that whole story? 1065,
etc. Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. So, you know, I know some things, but obviously lots of bits and pieces and interesting things about people I don't know. The elections in November of 1970 did not go well for Nixon. He had campaigned on a social issues platform. It didn't work the way he thought it was, and after that it became clear that the economy was going to be very important. You couldn't campaign against anti-war protesters, and it became clear that, at least to Nixon, that the unemployment rate had to be down to 4.5% by summer 72. So there's a change within the administration. Economics becomes much more important. Secretary Kennedy is sacrificed. Connally comes in, who's a can-do guy, and he's drawn the conclusion from the elections and from talking to businessmen that the business community would support price controls.
Because, before we get to that, That all happens after this 1065 story.
Okay, well, let's start with 1065. But 1065 comes out of this period. There's the council is in danger of being
losing its power, but not to Connally, but to Schultz.
Right. I mean, the council is told, basically led Nixon to believe, that you can bring inflation down with a moderate rise in unemployment, and here you are 2 years into the administration with 6% inflation and, you know, whatever, almost 6% unemployment, and the council has egg in his face. So after the elections, they come up with a figure that's going to, you know, a path that'll bring the unemployment rate down to...
Right, but the council opposed this number. I mean, that's what I'm trying to get to.
Okay, so I'm doing all the talking. I'm just trying to...
Let me tell you the story I heard when I got there. Okay. And then you can... Schultz needed 1060... Schultz is running the budget, the OMB or whatever it was called.
Yes.
Okay. George Schultz.
Yeah.
And he needed, in order to get the revenue that he wanted, he needed a GDP of 1065.
So he came up with the 1065.
Well, that's a little complicated. He then got Art Laffer to build him a monetarist model. This is what I'm trying to get to your question about monetarism. These guys come in and not monetarists. Remember, Stein writes this book basically about how Keynes comes to America, et cetera.
Right.
Okay, so they're kind of sort of soft Keynesians. Okay.
Right.
Schultz gets, this is a story I heard, and I don't know whether any of this is true. Okay.
Oh, sure.
Let me just preface this with, okay. The story is that Schultz needs 1065. He gets Laffer to write him a two-equation model that gets him 1065. The council's forecast is 1045, but Schultz imposes 1065. GSA, we don't know. What will key be, we don't know. What's the total of 1065? So the council's kind of fighting for its independence and sort of humiliated at the same time. And this would be the beginning of 71.
No, that's right. That's right. I have a quote from Maisel's book. Maisel did not like George Shultz for sure. And he says, I can give you the quote, the president's economic staff was informed that the forecast for the economy for 1972 had to be higher. Overnight, the estimate for GNP growth was raised from just over $70 billion to $88 billion, or by almost 25%, to reach a level of $1065
billion. Right. Internal battle. The other part of this is, this is an aside, so on the sociology of knowledge, I don't know if it's interesting.
Anything you say is interesting, because okay. We're 30 years away from
it.
I
mean, what then happens is how, in some sense, the council was defending sort of what was then professional, this is before I got there, so I'm not there, okay?
Sure.
I'm just telling stories, okay? The council has to defend, the council is basically kind of mainline soft Keynesianism that everybody believed in those days.
Mm-hmm.
The monetarism gets imposed on them, and so the question is, the council is really representing the profession, and so the question is, how does the profession get even? And you know this story, or...
No, go on. But when you say this is the story you heard, was this in conversations with Stein, for example?
Well, no, this is in conversations. Well, I'll tell you the story, and then you can hear it. You'll
okay.
Say it. So the question is, Laffer, within a sense, I'll just say the story, and you can
sure.
It's a true story. Okay. Samuelson then goes out to Chicago to give a talk. And during the talk, he says, as Mr. Laffer said, Stigler then comes over to Samuelson and says, what do you mean, Paul? It's Dr. Laffer, not Mr. Laffer. Because Laffer at that point had been made the youngest full professor in the history of the University of Chicago, and Stigler had been chairman of the committee that promoted him. Samuelson said, no, well, you're wrong. It turned out Laffer did not have his degree. And then when Laffer returned to Chicago, he was told he'd never get another raise. And so it was the profession imposing its discipline. Now, and how Samuelson knew all this or how all this happened, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I was a graduate student at Chicago then.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I was just getting... buzz, but what Laffer did was to run the St. Louis equation using not seasonally adjusted data. So he picked up an enormous seasonal between M1 and GNP, which gave you a huge kick.
Uh-huh.
And Friedman, for sure, you know, thought that was outrageous. And Friedman was no fan of using the St. Louis equation to fine-tune the economy. You know, he wanted 3% M2 growth and then walk away from it. I think the Friedman side of it sort of undercut Laffer at Chicago.
Well, I see, right, because it was too... Right. But that was the beginnings of the sort of monetarism, as far as I can tell, in the... It wasn't that McCracken and Stein were post-monetarism, I don't think. It was just that is the way they were.
Right. But it came down from Nixon that you had to have 4.5% unemployment They used the St. Louis equation to see, well, how do we get that much nominal GNP growth? And they made some assumption about what inflation would be given what they thought the output gap was.
All right.
That was one of the equations. And they come up with this 1065. But then the debate is over how much money growth you need
to
get that. Right? And it's all sort of strange because the council doesn't control money growth.
No,
the Fed does.
And, you know, I don't know what the number looks like right now, but there was a period when when 1065 turned out to be the right number.
Right, but that's not known until...
Much later.
Right.
I mean, 10 years later. I mean, a revision of a revision.
Well, no, I think that going into 72, it was pretty clear that they would meet it, although the question was, well, why are you meeting it? There's some... but the... We talked about the price controls. By July of 1971, it looks like you're not going to meet it.
Right.
And you're not going to meet the 1065, and you're not going to get the unemployment is still hanging tough.
Mm-hmm.
And so, at that point, Schultz loses to Connally.
Right. And Connally sort of formed an alliance with Stein and those other people, all of whom wanted a more expansionary policy.
Yeah. So I don't want to jump too far ahead and miss things. When you come in, what do you start working on?
I started working with Rudy. There was what the results of a temporary investment tax credit would be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a funny story because we got a number. I don't remember what it was. Then they put in a permanent one, and we kept getting compliments from everyone about what great forecasters we were. But of course, it was all bogus because you know the temporary and the permanent one would be a very different number.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I started working on when we first came in. And then what happened was things were very slow, and then suddenly, I would say about the third week in July or so, everybody went crazy with stuff to do. I discovered that all the people I used to have lunch with, no one was free.
Well, that's the mid-year review of the economy and the testimony before the JEC.
Right.
And Burns testifies at the same time. Got this famous quote, the laws of economics are no longer working. The council's got to defend its 1065 forecast, and Nixon's looking for a new economic policy, and he's talking to Connally and Schultz.
Right. And they're off their end. You know, like, we were then given the task, what would happen if there were a 10% export subsidy with a 10% import tariff?
Oh, so you were asked that question in July, because the...
That question in July, I can't tell you the exact date, but... Suddenly there was this incredible flurry of activity when they were all getting ready for Camp David.
Yeah, that must have been just as August gets started.
Probably the beginning of August, and
yeah.
You know, no one used the word devaluation, so we were given this, this symmetric thing to work on, and... You know, as looking back afterwards, everyone's given essentially a piece of the package to do estimates with.
Yeah, Connally puts together this package. He realizes that businessmen want wage controls to deal with labor militancy. And, of course, if you're going to have wage controls, you have to have price controls. And then you need to do something for labor. Well, labor is protectionist. So the import surcharge is for labor. And the whole thing is packaged.
A little bit more complicated, because what labor really wanted was an excess profits tax.
And that I hadn't heard of.
Yeah, and Treasury refused. I should say labor. I mean, a big thing on the table was how... If you're going to have an income policy, why aren't you also dealing with profits? And what happened was there was a memo from the Treasury saying that they were still trying to collect the excess profit taxes from World War II, and they did not want the bureaucratic influence. But as I remember it, the kind of White House wanted an excess profit tax, but the Treasury opposed it.
That's interesting.
I'm not saying, I don't, you know, this is a long time ago.
Well, No, that sounds right. So then you get the Committee on Interest and Dividends.
Right.
And you can't increase your dividend payout rate, and effectively banks are kept from raising rates on things
right.
like loans to consumers, farmers, and so on. So it's handled informally, but it's part of the pressure on the Fed because it gets tied up with interest rates. If you can't have a wage increase, how can a guy who goes out to get a mortgage be expected to pay higher mortgage payments?
Right. So that was all part of the same thing. But if you notice, the one thing that's not in there, the only income that's not controlled is profits.
And interest rates,
right.
And they're sort of...
Interest rates, presumably for the same reason.
It's... Burns doesn't want controls in interest rates because he wants control over monetary policy. Plus, to be fair to the council realizes that controls in interest rates are very easy to circumvent. By this point, you've got the Eurodollar market because of the capital controls and Regulation Q in the 60s, and the council realizes that lending's going to go offshore and...
As everyone said, you know, all those guys during the wage and price controls really felt like prostitutes, you know, and so they were quite willing, you know. I mean, you had wage and price controls being run by people who opposed wage and price controls. It was a little...
Well, yes, except that it's a little more complicated than that because McCracken, at the beginning of 61... is pushing along with Mitchell at Justice, you remember him.
Yeah.
They're pushing for an economic crimes tribunal, a special court that can charge businesses with charging excess profits. And that doesn't go anywhere. The people at the White House, like Flanagan, are horrified by that sort of government intervention. So by June of 71, McCracken privately is recommending price controls to Nixon.
But people like Stein, those guys, I'm talking about the people like Marvin Costers.
Yeah.
He is not a man who is deeply committed to wage and price controls,
Oh.
I'm sure he was there, running a major part of it, a whole bunch of, a large part of what later emerges as AEI was running wage and price controls.
Right, and it's really Connally.
It's Connally who...
He puts together...
What suddenly happens is... I was on the Troika, the forecasters.
Okay.
I mean, so we would meet. And it was quite clear that the Treasury was in charge. And that changed as the summer went along. Their numbers were the numbers. And Connally was clearly in charge, and he had the president's ear, and I don't think anyone else had any, Connally was the economic czar.
Yeah, he replaced Schultz, so it must have been a terrible time for Schultz until Connally leaves a year
later. And Connally was a bully, and Connally was not, a free marketeer. I mean, Connally's not a University of Chicago, type.
Right.
The famous story about when he got into a battle with Death Meat on the value of the dollar. He said something like, you guys were winning and now we're winning. It was that kind of macho.
I hadn't heard that, but the statement I remember him saying was that it may be our dollar, but it's your problem.
It was even stronger. It was this sort of one funny little thing happened, because when we went and we did our forecast after the August 15th thing, McCracken said, well, I don't have the order of magnitude of the numbers right anymore, you know, but he said, well, let's throw in X dollars for confidence. So he came in with the number that came out was a lot larger.
Well, that, but Arthur Burns...
I've been wrong. I mean, hey, well.
But Arthur Burns, that was his big thing, that confidence of the businessman would power
the
recovery.
Right. Just hold on, I'll be back in 1 minute, if you have 1 second, okay?
Oh, sure.
Well, I know it is widely known, but Arthur Burns gets this rap for, raising money supply to get Nixon reelected.
Yeah.
Something I want to say is that the two things about that. One is that what's not widely known is that the first fiscal policy initiative was tried. What happened was that there was they had gotten to Nixon this is around October or November. Remember, I hope you're right. I'm just a senior staff economist. So I'm not a participant in any of this. Okay. Except the next part of the story, which is that and he had agreed that he would be willing to have an expansionary fiscal policy with an extra $10 billion worth of deficits if people could show him how it would help him get reelected the following November. And there was a task force appointed to figure out what to do with this $10 billion. And it's a classical story. It failed because the president wouldn't let you cut taxes because he was getting into all sorts of fights with Wilbur Mills, and he just didn't want to deal with him anymore. And you could not raise the defense budget because Cap Weinberger, at that point, was the defense analyst at the at OMB, or whatever it's called then. And he had gotten the defense budget under control, and they were afraid of the defense budget getting unleashed. So we were supposed to go and figure out how to spend another $10 billion to have an effect by November. And it turned out it was really impossible to do, because any programs you came up with would kind of, you know, the standard lags in fiscal policy all occurred. And so it was only, I think, after this fiscal policy initiative failed that they turned to Burns. But I don't know that for certainty, but what I do know for certainty is that there was a guy named Frank Ripley, who was the forecaster. And he was in charge of an interagency group to try to figure out how to spend this $10 billion for a fiscal expansion.
Well, there was a, quote, problem during this whole period that even when amounts were legislated and appropriated, agencies were slow spending them. So there was lots of panic. But how do you get these government agencies to, you know, speed up the rate at which they're spending?
Well, our problem is that, we could go and build $10 billion worth of daycare centers, but given that the president had to put in the State of Union address, there's no way you're going to get them built by the following November, or even started. So, with that, the first example I knew of where the advantages of monetary policy over fiscal policy became pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
So in those days, people really thought monetary policy had long and variable lags of up to 18 months, so I'm not even...
Well, there were different schools. Again, the St. Louis...
Right,
people had this equation, and that's
know.
What they were, and that's what the McCracken and Stein were using this regression of GNP on lag money and the.
Right, and you know the guy who was doing the money stuff, you probably knew in Chicago. Did you know Bill Gibson?
Yes, I did. He was gone when I was there, but I have met him. I did know him, and I think Phil Kagan was there for a year before you came.
Right. And then Gibson, Ezra Solomon was there too, but Gibson was the staff monetary guy, and they relied very heavily on him.
That's interesting. I should talk to him. He's dropped out of sight.
You know that story.
He had an SNL problem.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So, but I should...
No, it wasn't an SNL problem. No, no, he made his money on SNL. It's a, no, it's a terrible story. What he did was he charged people for first-class tickets and then turned them in.
Yeah, it was a silly little thing.
Silly. And it was just for the greed of the, you know.
But his SNL got audited in the...
Oh, his SNL got... Oh, that's how they found out?
That's, yeah, that's when they needed... I think it went insolvent, and when the regulatory agencies took it over, they audited it and discovered this thing, which was just a trivial amount of money, and the guy had lots and lots of money, but it was just...
I don't know why they went after it. But in any case, he was a very smart guy, and they were very dependent on him for monetary policy.
That's very interesting. He still lives in Chicago someplace, so I think I can probably...
I would say he was, you know, among senior staff economists, he really was much more one of the, you know, insiders.
Mm. Well, he is, I assume still is, a very capable guy.
Oh, he's a very smart. No, I'm very fond of him. No. And they were right to depend on him. But I think the extent to which you want, I sort of did monetary policy and forecasting. Fiscal policy and forecasting.
Yeah.
You know, I would never have talked to anybody about monetary stuff at all. And Gibson would have. So he's probably, you know, I mean...
Yeah,
I have all these tidbits of gossip, but he probably knows exactly what they were doing.
Yeah,
and how they were doing it. He'd probably, you know, he'd really be a.
Okay, I'll track him down. He lives someplace in a Chicago suburb, and
what's he doing? Do you know?
Well, as far as I know, he's retired. I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard his name for 10 years now.
Yeah. He's a very smart, talented guy, and you know there were not. And people was, you know, it was all very early, and monetarism was not. Nixon came out and declared himself a Keynesian, so.
That was the thing about the budget, about giving up the full employment
budget. Right, when he did the full employment budget,
was Ezra Solomon there doing international while you were?
Ezra Solomon was there doing international. But of course, Marina was very influential.
But she came when Ezra left, right?
Oh, right, but she was on a senior staff before he came. She was she was a senior staff economist when I was there. But traditionally, the trade person is almost the fourth person, because traditionally the three regular people didn't know anything about trade.
Yeah,
and it was such an exotic thing. So she, I think she may have been there. I'm pretty sure she was there that July. I'm certain she was. I'm certain she was.
That sounds right. Yeah, I think so.
I'm certain she was. Yeah, so she, you know, she was, they were very dependent on her. Because I don't think either Stein nor McCracken really knew very much about the trade. Now, Hot Talker had left. Hot Talker
right.
Had been handling trade.
Right. So, how did your responsibilities evolve? Did you continue to do follow fiscal policy?
I was involved in the forecasting. I was there that famous day, you know, which is now the Treasury discovered it had $12 billion more revenue than it expected. Do you know that whole tale?
No, I didn't.
Well, this is part of the lore of, you know, whether you want permanent or temporary tax cuts and stuff. What happened was that we were, I can't tell you the exact date or anything, but, I mean, this has been written up in a number of places because it's so... what happened was that the guys from the Treasury come in and say that they found an extra $1 billion that month. And this was in this month. Oh, I knew when it had to be. It had to be in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And every month there was this the first month, who knew? You know, in those days, that was real money. I mean, I have to be
sure. Oh yeah.
So, okay. It turns out that on an annual basis, there was $12 billion extra coming in. And when you think of the fact that those deficits we're fighting about, you know, were $10 billion, you know, and what had happened was that the Treasury had changed the withholding forms. You know, I don't remember, I mean, I'm just starting to remember. As a result of which, people were being overwithheld. Okay, so the money, they would get the money back the following year, but it was overwithheld the first year. And thank God it was the Treasury that made the mistake, or I think Connolly would have, you know.
I see, because that made monetary policy more restrictive than it would have been otherwise.
Right, exactly. I mean, fiscal policy, right. Should be much more restrictive. And so, I mean, in the Keynesian mindset of the period, that would have been the perfect way to sabotage the economy, to get a recession before the election. And so they ended up doing things like newspaper ads and getting on TV telling people to go change their withholding because they were so afraid, you know. And it turns out, as I remember, that consumption did not really... people sort of treated it like permanent income, in the sense that they knew that they had the refund back, and they didn't really change their behavior. It became one of the famous experiments on permanent versus temporary tax cuts. This was neither a permanent nor a temporary tax cut. It was a reshuffling of tax cuts over time. But in those days, people were, you know, Keynesians, and so there was this great fear that Nixon would lose the election because some clerk in the Treasury Department had missed down the withholding stuff.
How did you characterize yourself at this time? Were you soft Keynesian, or?
Oh, yeah. We were all, I would say, yes.
That was your term.
Maybe harder Keynesian.
Sort of Republican Keynesianism, I sort of would have.
Yeah. And I think that, I think, also, I remember the Dave Stein came in, this is a good quote, okay, he came in, and he had just been having lunch with Dennison, and, this is a good quote, the other one, and he, and the productivity numbers started, you know, that just when the productivity numbers started turning bad was 1972. And there was this, you know, the question was this, and Dennison was very upset, and was this a blip? Because the other story was Stein, when told about, what people wanted to do was just shift the Phillips curve downward, said he just wanted to get on it. But I would say that I was certainly quite Keynesian, and I would say Stein, I mean, I can't speak from Italy, but remember, he came out of the CD, he had written this stuff. Remember,
right.
You know, he was a public finance man, he was Peckman protege.
Oh, sure.
I mean, they had worked together, they were similar age. And I would say that, you know, the general view was kind of mainline Keynesianism of the 45-degree line, maybe ISLM. And I think, you know, the wage and price control thing also, in terms of the, you know, remember they had it in 52, but when they did the wage and price control, they brought back Dick Nelson's father, who had worked in wage and price controls during the Second World War, too.
I knew the name, but I didn't know it was any relation.
It's his father, I'm pretty sure.
Hmm.
You could say, I could be wrong, but
I see him once in a while, so I'll ask him.
Oh, you could see Dick? Or the father?
Well, Richard Nelson.
Richard, yeah. So, I mean, that was the sort of thing I remember at the time. Adams were there, who was a Klein person that were left over from
the Oaken and Ackley
administration. Yeah, and I remember, for example, having to write a memo for Stein where Klein had written him something on wage and price controls and why they should have them, you know. So, I mean, so they were really very much, I think they view themselves as sort of very professional. I think that McCracken, of course, did have this, the other part of the evaluation, of course, was, it wasn't labor, it was the auto industry. And McCracken was from Michigan. And he was, now I'm being unfair, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, we worried a lot more about autos
than
seemed justified by their proportion of the economy.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, it's one thing to be eclectic, it's another thing, or maybe it's the same thing, not to have very strong views, and I think that must have hurt McCracken and the council as time went on. Their forecasts had been consistently wrong. Unemployment had gone up, inflation had not gone down, and George Shultz had very strong views. He knew what
he wanted.
Yeah, and McCracken was more of the professional economist, I'll do the forecast, but they're contingent on this and this and this,
right.
The kind of things that politicians get driven up the wall.
I think Stein was is McCracken still alive?
Yes, oh sure.
Oh, yes, so I've been around, I mean, well, I'm,
well, this is off.
Off right, okay. I mean, there's no doubt but that Stein was the intellectual power there.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
I mean, McCracken,
Mr. Stein comes across as very aggressive in terms of organizing the strategy for how to influence the Fed. And McCracken comes across, at least in reading the memos, more as the professional forecaster who's kind of basically giving you the consensus forecast in the economic community.
When I came in, it was sort of towards the tail end of McCracken, and I barely got to know him, but he certainly was, he was a very nice man.
Oh, absolutely. I've talked to him a number of times.
He was the loveliest man, but, he certainly, did sort of give off the firepower. I mean, Stein, you read a memo thing for Stein, and he, you could expect to be ripped, I don't mean unkindly,
mm-hmm.
but, he really knew a lot and mm-hmm. was very well informed and could outright any, there was this time when he didn't like the last draft of the CA report, so he just went home for a weekend and wrote it.
Yeah, he was very capable and had a very forceful
personality. And he, my kind of very casual impression, was that he kind of drifted to the right over time.
I think that has to be right. I don't think the council has a lot of clout in terms of determining what happened, but Stein was the one who mounted the organized the attack within the administration on the Fed, and he wrote memos before Camp David saying that, well, if Burns wants wage and price controls in return for an expansionary monetary policy, we ought to at least talk to him about that.
Uh-huh.
Later on, I showed him those memos, and he said, well, I couldn't have written that. But of course he did. But then he really seems to kind of come into his own and sort of grow in stature as he becomes CEA head after McCracken leaves. I think he's very influential along with George Shultz, and I think he was, from once he becomes head of the CEA, he's a very important voice along with Shultz in terms of kind of always trying to think, how are we going to get out from under these controls? Because at the time, they could have become permanent. You didn't, that wasn't out of the question. But for Shultz and Stein, you know, it was out of the question. They were going to end them.
Oh yeah. Well, I said I think that they, you know.
And Arnold Weber too.
Arnold Weber, right, another guy, you know, right. I mean, that's not saying only these guys didn't really, you know, believe it. I think one thing they did in the beginning, which may have been part of it, was in the beginning that there was some council or something, or there was a council that met with that dealt with all the issues that arose, and it was the most senior people in the government were sitting here and doing things. And I actually have a memo which I always read to my class, which was they had. This involved all the secretaries of media, okay, and they had there was this great discussion about what to do with Halloween candy.
Oh.
Okay, because, you see, there was a freeze-off.
Yeah.
So the question was Halloween candy, the chocolate witches, okay, were they chocolate, in which case they were frozen, okay, or were they witches, in which case they were new, or the other way around, okay? So where is the freeze extent to the pre anyway? And it's actually a memo on how to treat holiday candy.
Yeah, it's probably the other way around because commodity prices were not frozen because they were traded internationally.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
The price of candy would have been frozen.
If you can imagine, I always thought that was done purposely just to waste the time of all these people so that they would want to get rid of it as soon as possible.
Well, one of the issues that comes up right away is what to do about yard sale prices.
Uh-huh.
And it's the silliest thing in the world.
Right,
you know, there's no
right,
base
right,
price.
Right, right, right.
But they're trying to think about, you know, how is this going to play with the public and everybody's going to do their part and you got these housewives doing yard sales and, you know, what are we going to tell them? Well.
Right, no, as I said, I really felt that I was around then. I was not, or maybe, I may have left, but I was coming down to Washington a lot seeing people. And my impression was, you know, the people who were running it really just were not happy doing it. I mean, they became increasingly unhappy. I think part of it may have been that they were attacked by their friends in Chicago. And so, you know,
Well, I can remember George Shultz coming back to Chicago when I was a student there, and he gives a seminar. And, you know, privately how he felt about the controls. He opposed them to the end. But publicly, as Secretary of the Treasury, he had to defend, especially he was defending controls on hospitals and health care. And, you know, people really, really went after him. And, you know, he was a good soldier and, you know, he had no choice but to defend them. But he clearly was uncomfortable.
Right. So I think these guys were out there and they were being, you know, being attacked by everyone. I think Marina became one of the people running it too, right?
Okay. Right.
I think she was a great fan of it.
She was a great fan of.
I don't think she was a great fan of.
Was not.
I mean, none of them were.
Yeah. No.
They worked as, though, in all fairness, the other way, you know, for the first 2 or 3 months, everything worked.
Yeah.
And they were more than willing to take the credit.
Yeah. And they were just so enormously popular politically.
Everyone loved them. They were right.
The argument had always been that, well, Shultz's argument had always been that, well, yeah, you can impose them, but they'll break down very quickly because you'll have strikes and the labor unions will, you know, view it as a challenge. And so if you're going to impose them, you know, do them and then get rid of them right away. But they were so popular that Nixon was really...
No, I remember sort of like being in Washington and saying where I worked, and people just, you know, it wasn't quite like, being an economist in the 60s. But I think everyone was dying to be a 60s economist again, you know.
Mm-hmm. Because of the prestige. I mean, everybody
there's
knew.
There's a famous quote by Art Oaken about, I don't remember, I have it exactly, but I'll tell you right now. The glory to have been an economist in the early 60s. You know, you were great heroes, you know. The economy was doing brilliantly, and you got to give Walter Howell credit. He made it look like it was all his doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one reason why they were all excited about it. But Stein was a very impressive figure, and I think he had a good political sense about who to go with. Well, and he was incredibly loyal to Nixon.
Yeah.
I think, they were not happy with it at the end. But when it started, everyone was very enthused. I mean, I think there was a real... The other thing one has to say that if you read the... I'll be back. Just give me one more minute. I'm sorry. There were all these editorials in the Washington Post and Brookings, and everyone was really pushing for a more stimulative policy.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why I think it wasn't as if this was all, I mean, everything's political on one level, okay. But I don't think that there was anyone, there weren't any people around saying, we're on track, boys, things are great, no, let's not do anything. I mean, I think everyone wanted, he'd always use the example of the political business cycle, but my feeling is, you go out there and read Brookings, okay?
Yeah.
And Burns listened to Brookings, so people shouldn't, he's really gotten a bad rap. No, I'm not saying he didn't do it also to re-elect Nixon,
Well, I don't think in his own mind he saw it that way. He wanted to maintain influence within the administration so that he could help set the target for wage inflation. He really believed in the controls, and he really believed that if you set a low target for wage inflation, you could pull inflation down and still stimulate the economy. So he was never willing to break with Nixon, because he wanted to run fiscal policy and wage and price controls. He wanted to run the whole...
He wanted to run everything. What he did was what the conventional wisdom was.
Yeah.
And I've always said, for the last 30 years, we get speakers coming by who are always using Burns as this example of, using monetary policy to for political purposes. But I just remember at the time, no matter what you picked up, no one is innocent, but I think he's really gotten a bum rap. He was just doing what everybody wanted to do, and get that unemployment rate down. But the conventional wisdom certainly is that he's the villain of the piece.
Yeah, no, I agree with you in that. I mean, as a Fed chairman, he allowed too much money growth, but there weren't very many people at the time who were concerned about that.
I'm not saying he did the right thing, but I don't. But you got to put you shouldn't read Aristotle because he owned a slave. I mean, that was the conventional wisdom at the time, and he did. The best he could, given that. I mean, he was certainly part of your job was to read the newspapers and things, and clearly, everyone was pushing for an expansionary policy, and he gave it to them.
Yeah.
What I do think about that story is that there was an attempt at fiscal policy that got aborted.
Because of the difficulty of getting the spending. Yeah, that's interesting. So how long were you in Washington?
Just a year.
Mm-hmm. Were you up all night times, or was it a pretty reasonable sort of place to work?
It was a pretty reasonable place. I think the only time that was really crazy was right about before August 15th.
Yeah.
The other story, the Hard Talker story on this.
No, I never talked to him.
About nighttime. Well, he, even no matter what the crisis was, would never come in on Sunday. And his view was, I need a day of rest. If there's a crisis on Sunday, there'll be a crisis on Monday. If there's a crisis on Monday, I want to be awake. And it was kind of amazing, in the most incredible, when people were, coming in Sundays, going crazy, etc., he would not appear.
Hmm.
I'm sure the other members resented it, but it was an ironclad rule of his, and, you know, and I think he may have also been religious, and I think it may have also been, part of it. But I would say that it was not a council that went, well, the people who tended to have to put in very, very long hours were the people in trade.
Yeah.
Because during that period, you know, there was agreement after agreement on the, remember there was the Waldorf agreement and this one and that one, and they were constantly repegging the dollar, and those people were really...
all the Smithsonian...
Smithsonian Accord, one accord after another, and that was all Connolly, and... and there really weren't that many people around who knew it.
Yeah.
I mean, in those days, very few people did international trade. I mean, it wasn't that major part of the U.S. economy. And so those people went really very, very crazy. But I would say, and the other part, of course, was that Stein really did so much of his own writing.
Yeah.
I mean, no one could write it half as well. I mean, in a way, it was absurd for someone to write a draft because it was just silly, because he would just... But I would say that... And Gibson, for example, never came in before 10:30. That was a matter of policy. Now, I don't know how late he stayed, but he was never there before 10:30 in the morning. He would saunter in at 10:30. Once again, nothing... in all fairness to all these people, they may have made a deal before they were hired. You know, I mean, Gibson probably worked well at night and not by day. And, I would say I think people worked very hard, but it was not a, except that August 15th there. Plus, the other thing that happens is the focus moves to the wage and price controls. So people like Stein are really much more preoccupied with that wage and price council during that period.
Yeah.
The council begins to bed down. But I would say that the council, from talking to my friends who've recently been on a council, things like that, I would say the council at that point was quite influential. I remember, who was the secretary of HHS? I think I know. Anyway, let's call him Mr. X. We were much more involved in, I think it was Social Security policy than he was, because his staff would always call us because they never knew what was going on. So I think the council was really quite involved, and I think Stein was very much, Stein and Cracker were much more involved, much more than, let's say, what was his name at the council, the last guy,
You mean before Stein?
What?
You mean before Stein?
No, not now. Recently,
sure. Bailey.
Bailey, okay. Nick,
yeah, people don't even know the name
anymore. From what I hear, they were just...
It was Yellen before that, and then Stiglitz, and...
Right. And then they just were, I think that, partly, I think there were probably fewer people, and there was still this troika tradition, which was really worked on the staff. Like, for example, it no longer is a troika kind of thing at the staff level, at what they forecasting, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, people would really sit down and, and try to do these sorts of things, and often the council was sort of the lead in the forecasting stuff. And in those days, people took forecasting, very seriously.
Yeah, right. That was the Keynesian environment.
Right, it was the Keynesian world, right. And so, the forecast was the number on which everything else then hinged.
Yeah.
And it was a very Keynesian world. I mean, it just wasn't that... people just were not in the I mean, as I said, Laffer was, you know, viewed as, you know, an outsider. It's not even clear that Laffer would have done what he did if George Shultz didn't need those numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was a very changing world, and still sort of a world that kind of looked back at the early 60s as, you know, the right thing for everything to be. You know, I think, I sort of Walter Heller and those, I mean, that was the image that everybody.
Yeah, 4% unemployment and 4% real growth.
4% unemployment,
and,
right.
Know, 2% inflation.
You measured gaps.
Yeah, and if it didn't work that way, then something was wrong. You needed wage and price controls.
But it's like,
well,
you need to do something, right. Or spend money. People still believe the fiscal policy in those days. Yeah. And remember, they still believe the fiscal policy even through. Remember, Charlie Shultz comes in with Carter.
Yeah.
Remember, they were taxed, various taxes here, and the current administration believes in fiscal policy. In fact, the current administration, in a way, almost sounds sort of almost like a Keynesian version. No, not dissimilar. I mean, Lindsay Sack.
Yeah.
Sounds a little bit like the people I knew in my youth. To some extent, the monetarism was almost like, like the way in which Republicans have to believe in abortion, the opposite, you know, be anti-abortion. I mean, sort of respectable people weren't doing this, you know, but you're working for these guys and that's what you do.
Respectable people weren't
monetarists, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and if one had to say, you know, because remember way back then, the same, you know, and remember, I mean, the St. Louis Fed came out of nowhere, and, you know, in terms of what's in the sociology of the profession, these were guys who came out of Minnesota who, you know, were not the top of the line, and they really, it really wasn't the profession. I don't want to sound like Stiglitz and making crap. No, but they were really outside, really outside of the mainstream. They weren't even Chicago people.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, they came out of UCLA, I think.
No, it's Minnesota.
The St. Louis people?
Yeah, the St. Louis Fed model was built. What was the guy who built it?
Jordan and Anderson.
Anderson, I'm pretty. And I think was the Minnesota. No, a lot of them were out of Minnesota. It doesn't matter. I think they were not out of Chicago.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of isolated. Place, and there was no place else that was, you know, that was really kind of doing that stuff. It was all ISLM and
fiscal policy.
And I think in general, most of these people believed in fiscal policy.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been that. I mean, Stein. Remember, Stein's whole life was devoted to a history of fiscal policy.
I read his book.
And I don't think McCracken sort of had the theoretical depth to even, you know, to do these things.
Yeah, I mean, Stein writes in his book that the reason you got the 1960 recession, at least the, you know, he seems to sign on to it, was because the Eisenhower people created a full employment surplus with their tax increases and unwillingness to cut taxes.
And then you get the quote in there about, of course, Burns going to Nixon. You know that story.
About the recession, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get the 64 tax cut and things.
And then the world takes off. Right. And that's a great, glorious moment when we're all proud to be economists. So, that's that book. That's what it's all about, in a way, is how we learned enough to have the 64 tax. I think that's where the profession was. I mean, the question is, was there anyone who was a monetarist who was not at Chicago?
Well, there was Carl Bruner at UCLA. And Alan Meltzer at...
Alan Meltzer,
The ones who were... Milton Friedman was the guy with the disciples.
Right.
And he was
Friedman
at Chicago.
Friedman was the disciples, right.
Yeah.
But Stein and McCracken are of an older generation.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
and
Stein had been in the council on the Eisenhower administration.
Right.
I mean, McCracken.
McCracken had been in the administration, right, and so had Burns.
Oh, yeah. For sure, Burns was Eisenhower's first...
Chair of the council, right. You know, right. And so I think that... I think that they were just not in I think they care about monetary policy, but in all fairness, I think Gibson was someone they really depended on.
Mm-hmm.
And he had come right out of the University of Chicago. Was he still teaching there? I don't remember.
Well, he was a student at Chicago, and then he went to UCLA.
He went to UCLA and then came to the council, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so he was really, you know, he was mainstream monetarist, and he's sort of the influential person.
That's interesting.
Yeah. By influential, I mean he was often in their offices.
Mm-hmm.
And they clearly respected him because he was able to get away with, you know, as I say, marching into 10:30, and he was not going to hang around until somebody needed him. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I really liked him a lot. I say this with a great deal of affection. I mean, he was a real character and with a lot of independence and... But I think if you want to know the monetary, if you want to know sort of, if you're doing the monetary policy, and he's probably the guy to talk to.
Okay. Well, I got to run him down, but somebody like Milton Friedman might have his phone number, so I'll work on that.
Okay. Good. Hmm? I should thank you for hiring all of my students.
Well, you know.